Spring is here, so why is this an especially dangerous time for icing? I'm Paul Platt, and this is Aero News. Welcome into the Aero News special feature. Thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. Also of Bob Miller Flight Training, Western New York's newest Part 141 flight school. Bob, we're going to talk about ice today, and I have to tell you that I don't really understand why we're talking about it right now, but we'll get into that in a second. First, just thanks for taking some time for our listeners today.
Well, thanks, Paul. I enjoy being with you here.
All right. You have an article headlined, Springtime Flying Means Ice, in the April edition of Over the Airwaves. And I guess having talked about ice earlier in the year when we were still looking at winter, I think of springtime as the time when we stop thinking about ice, but apparently that's not the case at altitude.
Well, you know, I live up here in, as you know, in the Buffalo area, which is about 30 miles north of our snow belt area where the ski areas are. And the ski area operators tell us in January and February, unless it's snowing on the ground in Buffalo, we will not get a bumper crowd of skiers down in the ski area. And I use that as an example. When we're on the ground in the springtime and the daisies are, or the daffodils are coming up and it's, you know, it's a balmy 52, 55, maybe 65 degrees, all thoughts of ice begin to quickly pass away. But it doesn't take much altitude or it doesn't take much more than the passage of a cold front or even a warm front that we're in on the ground to collide with a cold front and create a situation which very easily produces something called SLDs, super large droplets, or in many cases, freezing rain. And that's when we get a cold front slipping in under a warm front or a warm front slipping over a cold front. That frontal passage that takes place in the springtime, the pilot is moving from surface temperatures that are well above freezing to temperatures aloft that are below freezing, and if we have any moisture associated with that, we're going to pick up airframe ice and perhaps lots of it. And the only difference that makes springtime unique from the other times of the year is we're not expecting it. And when we're not expecting it, like anything else in aviation, that's when it can hurt us the most.
It's interesting you mentioned that too, Bob, because I know, especially in your part of the country, this is a time of year when an awful lot of people who haven't flown in months are swinging open those big barn doors and rolling their machines out for the first flight of the year. Is the lack of proficiency and just the sheer number of people shaking the rust off a factor in making this particular time of the year a tough one for ice issues?
I don't think it's the less than proficient pilot or the pilot that you've just described. I think it's the folks that travel a lot, that do a lot of cross country flying. They're on the ground and, you know, it's warm on the ground and we're thinking that, you know, everything is going to be fine. We don't bother to look at those temperatures aloft. But it's not so much when the lapse rate or the normal decline in temperature as we climb, when that's normal, that's not the issue. The issue is whenever we have a frontal passage, when we're changing air mass systems from warm to cold or freezing to below freezing. And when this happens in the springtime, we may be seeing some of the greatest temperature ranges from, as I said, on the surface, 40, 50, 60, maybe 70 degrees on the surface, and then we climb up and get into a frontal passage, which is still bringing a polar front down from Canada, which could be very much below freezing, you know, could be down in the, on the Fahrenheit scale, down in the teens, and then we have this warm air from the south colliding, warm, moist air, colliding with a polar mass coming from Canada in April or March, the temperature change can be horrific. And if that warm air is dropping rain through the colder air below, my goodness, we have a scenario that's conducive to either freezing rain in the worst situation, or in the best of cases, something that we talked about earlier, these super large droplets, which are simply water molecules that are below freezing but are still in liquid form until they strike the airframe. That's the difference. We have these polar cold masses from the north that exists, that still exist in the springtime months, matching up with a warmer maritime and southern flow of air from the south that's moisture rich, and then wham. I have not done an accident study to compare or correlate icing accidents by season. That would be a very interesting analysis of the data, but I suspect empirically or anecdotally that it would be significantly worse in the springtime.
Okay. In the spirit of bring me solutions, not problems, what do we do about this? Does everybody who's going to fly, or actually the profile you talked about, the person who is a frequent cross-country flyer, maybe a frequent IFR flyer, does that person need to do some brushing up on meteorology in the month of March and April?
Paul, you asked the pertinent question. That is absolutely the best question that we can ask in a discussion like this. The one thing that any of us can look at is frontal passage in the springtime. If our trip is going from point A to point B is going to cause us to pass through a front, beware. If that trip is going to cause us to pass alongside or near a low pressure area, beware. Worse, if we're going to have a frontal passage and a low pressure area along our route of flight, that's a double, kind of a double warning. Be very, very careful. On the other hand, if our trip is going to take us through essentially a big high pressure area or an area where there is no frontal activity, then chances are we're going to have a fine outcome. But you said it in summary. What we need to do is become junior meteorologists, understand the weather, understand how to read a surface analysis chart and look at the temperatures aloft. Be very aware of what's going to happen if we do experience either that frontal passage or a low anytime, but particularly in the springtime.
All right, Bob, when we come back from the break, I want to talk for a moment about something that's a year-round safety issue, but I think it's particularly relevant at this time of year as well. My guest is Bob Miller. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Paul Plack, and you're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
This is a story of two pilots. Our first guy, the one with Garmin Waas GPS, he just arrived home from a trip, ready to enjoy a nice home-cooked meal with his supermodel girlfriend.
Chérie, viens près de moi.
But our other guy, the pilot without Waas, well, he couldn't quite make it home. Had to divert to an airport with an ILS approach. So now it's dinner from a vending machine in some crummy pilot's lounge. You know which pilot you want to be. Garmin Waas GPS. Follow the leader.
Chérie.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to the Aero News Special Feature. Paul Plack here with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. And Bob, you had an article in the April edition, which is one of the scariest things I can think of when I think about a safety issue in general aviation. And it was entitled, "Open the Door? Wait Until the Prop Stops." One of the things I'm involved in right now is I'm on the committee planning a small aircraft meet at an airport, municipal airport, north of the Salt Lake City metro area. One of the things that weighs heavily on my mind, more than any other issue, is there's an airport appreciation day on the Saturday of the weekend we're having the event. And that means there'll be a lot of people out and walking around and people who are not familiar with safety protocols around aircraft. And one of the things we're paying most attention to is how to make sure that people and hardware don't mix. In the case of the scenario you paint in the article, you're talking about, for example, a family or people, you know, passengers in your own aircraft, or especially kids who may not, have the savviness or awareness of moving propellers, and what we need to do to make sure to keep them safe. Tell us what inspired this article.
There was a very, very tragic, and as you said, Paul, perhaps the most horrific kind of accident we pilots can experience, and that is somebody colliding with the propeller spinning on our own airplane. In this particular accident, it was a tragic case where a Cessna 180 pulled up to a stop. The pilot permitted the right-hand passenger door to open. a child sitting in the back seat of the airplane was allowed to exit the aircraft as the door swung open, just as the pilot was shutting down the propeller. The child managed to get out of the airplane and walk in front just as the propeller was making its last turn. And we know what that looks like. It's just kind of a uneven roughness of the engine. It just made that last final dying swing and caught the child right in the head and killed the child instantly. And that visual picture, as I wrote this article, I have children, and those of us with children or who carry passengers know the horror that this represents. We have since altered our flight school policies and procedures in reaction to this, that there will not ever be any situation where a person is allowed to enter or exit an aircraft in one of our training aircraft without first shutting down the engine. Now, I know, and I've done this a dozen, two dozen, three dozen times, when we solo a student, you know, that anxious student, you know, he's made two or three passes, or landings and takeoffs, and he's ready to go. The engine's running, and the flight instructor, you know, signs his logbook and says, okay, best wishes, good luck, have a good time. And he opens the door while the air engine is still running, exits the aircraft, knowing fully that he can do this without running into the propeller, but sets a terrible example in doing that for the student who's about to solo. And so what we've done, as I said, and I think this should be made mandatory, certainly at every flight school, that there no doors will open in an aircraft until that engine is completely shut down.
Now, there are going to be times, I would think, when this is a more tempting thing to ignore than others. You know, I think of, you know, trips where you're dropping somebody off at an airport, then continuing on, or where maybe, you know, maybe you have an older plane that hasn't been maintained meticulously, and you're not sure about its hot starting capability.
Right. Good point.
I guess the bottom line is that you need to fix those other things, because there's really no point in rolling these dice.
Well, you know, I operate a big bore Continental engine, you know, and every time I start that engine, it's like just burning a $20 bill just on wear and tear on that engine each time I fire it up. And the last thing I want to do is shut it down momentarily and then start it right back up again. But here we go back into risk factor analysis and human factors, and how well can we control the direction that individual is going to move when they exit the airplane out the right-hand door. It is difficult starting some of these engines when they're hot, but we have to trade the risk. Now, here again, if we have two pilots, say two flight instructors, who know full well the dangers of that spinning propeller, when they do it, they say, you know, do as I say, not as I do. If we do it as flight instructors and we safely exit that aircraft while the engine's still running, what kind of picture does that paint in the minds of a, you know, an impressionable student who's back in the FBO watching this exercise take place? He's saying, well, maybe I can get in and out of an airplane when the engine is still running. You know, we've had several instances that I've reported about in over the airways where students have literally walked directly into a spinning propeller. Why does this happen? Why does this have to happen? What does it take to shut the engine down, let us suffer the consequences of having to make a hot start just to show the example of being sure that everybody is clear of that airplane before spinning propeller before we allow people to get in and out.
Well, Bob, I don't think talking about it here is going to end the practice entirely, but I hope it makes a few people think. And as always, we appreciate your bringing it up, and we'll talk to you again next Monday.
Thanks, Paul. Appreciate it.
You can find Bob Miller's latest writings in Over the Airwaves, the Journal for the Proficient Pilot, at overtheairwaves.com. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at aero-news.net. I'm Paul Platt. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.